Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guests tonight are Roberta J. M. Olson, curator of drawing at the New York Historical Society, and professor emerita of art history at Wheaton College, and J. M. Pasikoff, field memorial professor of astronomy and director of the Hopkins Observatory at Williams College. And we are continuing our conversation. This is part three about the beautiful and fascinating book that they wrote, Cosmos, the Art and Science of the Universe. Roberta and Jay, welcome back. It's a pleasure to talk to both of you again.
Well, we had such fun the last time. Yes.
Now, we're going to be talking...
Happy vernal equinox, by the
way.
Or spring.
I know. I love spring, but I hate spring allergies. And it's been weird. It's been weird weather here up until this week. You know, it's been really mild, and then it's been really cold, and then it's been really mild, and then it's been really cold. And I haven't gotten out to do a big night watching salamanders yet, so I'm looking forward to that. We're going to talk about the moon tonight. And the moon is really interesting because when I think about the moon, I think it's got to be the most frequently observed celestial object other than the sun. Is that safe to say?
You are correct, and maybe even more because it's easier to see. There are all kinds of hazards with gazing at the sun.
And did people, you know, I never asked this, did people realize that early on that you shouldn't be staring at the sun?
Well, it depends on who it was. We know that Taddeo Gaddi was partially blinded by the sun.
But did he realize it was the sun that blinded him?
Yes, because it was an eclipse. And we know that it's actually in records that he was blinded by it. But Jay can speak more to this, I think.
So, Jay, I mean, did people, how well?
Yes, I think even thousands of years ago, the idea was somebody in a tent saw a partial eclipse projected on the ground from BC. People took precautions. We don't know why Galileo went blind in the 1630s, whether it was looking at the sun or whether it was just some consequence of old age. But he had made a series of sunspot drawings that were published in 1613. So people knew how to project the sun. In 1639, for the transit of Venus, they used projection. There's a drawing in the Town Hall of Manchester, an oil painting actually, showing the projection of the solar image. So yeah, people knew that didn't stare at the sun.
And we know that when Donato Creti and Mazzini did their series of paintings for Marsili, who had instruments and wanted to convince the Pope to support his observatory, that those were also done by projection.
But the moon was a totally different story. And thinking about the moon, I mean, the moon is sometimes visible during the day. It goes through phases. I mean, how did early people think about the moon? I mean, first of all, early on, they didn't realize the moon went around the Earth, right? They thought it was just another celestial body.
That's in the Ptolemaic system. But even then, they realized something. It depends on who it was.
Well, when did they realize that we only saw one side of the moon?
Well, Leonardo realized it in the late 15th and early 16th centuries. He was so far beyond everything. He actually said that before Galileo, he said the sun doesn't move, okay? Whereas before, everyone thought that the sun moved around the Earth in the Ptolemaic system.
Yeah.
Which was, of course, replaced with Copernicus in the heretical 1543 De Revolution Omnibus. But Leonardo was one of the first people to do this. And he also... he made a mistake thinking that the Maria or the Mare on the moon was water, but he also realized that there was earth shine. He realized that the moon did not emit its own light, that it was reflected from the sun. And he also knew that you never saw the other side of the moon, which we know Pink Floyd's called The Dark Side of the Moon.
That's so funny because I was going to ask you about the Pink Floyd album, one of the most recognizable album covers in the world, and it's about the dark side of the moon. But
great song.
Now, Da Vinci did.
But many people get wrong what the dark side of the moon is, and confuse it with the far side of the moon. But half the time, the far side of the moon is bright. So the dark side is the side that's not illuminated. But aside from the nice T-shirt with a spectrum on it, which I which I love to show people, that leads to a lot of confusion.
So wait a minute, Jay. Wait a minute. Explain that in detail more. So there are parts of the moon that become dark. That's when we see like a crescent moon. But we're always still seeing
this. The moon is dark all the time.
Right.
So sometimes it's the near side and sometimes it's the far side.
But we never.
When we don't see the moon, that's when the near side is dark.
That's right.
And
except as Roberta just said, for the earth shine reflected onto it that Leonardo figured out.
Is that the thing that's called the Da Vinci glow?
The Da Vinci glow, yes. That's one term for it. Okay, or earth shine or planet shine. And what's interesting is that already in, it's estimated in like 39 BC with the Lumbumbo bones, which had 29 markings, and of course the lunar cycle is 29.5 days, that people began, in all civilizations actually, charting the months. Okay, by the 29 days of the moon cycle. So it was the major timekeeping device, and it was used for planting, for everything, and you could predict eclipses with it.
When did the terminology for the different phases of the moon come about, the waxing and waning, gibbous, and so on and so forth? When did that start?
That I don't know.
I don't know either. It's really interesting. It's current, and obviously the terms of English. And in the old, the manuscripts I know and treatises I know don't use those terms exactly.
Now, you were talking about images of the moon. Painters, especially from the Renaissance on, have really, there are a lot of paintings of the moon in your book. Raphael did an amazing series of images of the moon. And so when did the mapping and the naming of parts of the moon start?
The mapping of the moon, you really have to talk about Galileo in terms of, actually Leonardo mapping the moon, beginning it without naming it. And then you have, of course, Galileo with his telescopic observations of the moon and the Sidereus Nuncius, and Jason talk about that with his wonderful drawings and then the engravings that are published in the fact this book, the watercolors date about 1609, and he was looking at the moon through a telescope, and he actually began a diagram in the terminator, that is where the dark part and the light part and how irregular it is, to prove that there are, you know, craters and also hilly forms on the moon. And that sort of led to the eventual mapping. But you should have Jay talk about the Sidereus Nuncius and also some of the things that involved that.
Jay?
Well, there was an Englishman named Thomas Harriot, H-A-R-R.
Oh, yeah.
IOT, who at about the same time as Galileo in 1609 and 1610 made a number of drawings of the moon through a little telescope that he had. But the story I've heard is that he wasn't trained in drawing the way that Galileo was, so he didn't realize that the light and shadow was a three-dimensional event. And so some of his drawings are still around, but they just look like splotchy things. And he was also, I don't know exactly what he did, but he was a rich person. He wasn't rushing into print and trying to get a new job the way Galileo was. So he didn't publish that for a while. So Galileo was at about the same time, but Galileo realized that there was a three-dimensional effect going. And then he saw a bright spot. that on the moon through his telescope that got a little brighter and brighter and spread. So he realized that was a mountain sticking up. And then in the Sidereus Nuncius, there's a great big crater drawn there. And I've tried, together with a scientist at NASA who was in charge of the mapping for the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, to see exactly which crater it was that was drawn. But it probably was not an exact crater. Maybe Galileo told his artist to draw a big crater in 3D there at the bottom, which is bigger than any crater right on the Terminator, this line between light and dark. But in any case, Galileo figured it out, and now we have these maria from the Sidereus Nuncius. But there's been a lot of naming of lots of things on the moon in the hundreds of years since.
And even before Harriet, there was Gilbert, who mapped the moon, but it was flat. And again, like Harriet, he didn't rush to publish. And Galileo had that advantage, and Galileo had another advantage. He was trained in chiaroscuro and perspective. He, in other words, he took art lessons. He was quarantined, so he was
and apparently that matters.
Yeah, exactly. He all played well. Anyway, he was able to coordinate the eye with the hand because he had been trained to do it. And he became a member of this intellectual Accademia del Disegno in Florence. So he had both skills as a scientist and as an artist, which is why he was able to capture the incredible illumination of the moon. This is a wonderful, magical quality of it.
When did images of, like, the man in the moon start? Maybe you don't know that, but it's like one of the most common images we still see today of the crescent moon in the shape of a face. That seems to be...
Actually, it starts in literature. It starts with Plutarch, who wrote a treatise called On the Face and the Moon. And so you have it coming up in medieval times infrequently, but my first... discovery of it was Giotto.
Huh.
Here in a chapel, Giotto painted the Alice Thomas. He has a man in the moon, and it's a full frontal face that he shows on a waning crescent moon with Earth shine, and this is in 1301-1305. And so it continues. It actually replaced the mythology, the man in the moon replaced the Roman goddess Luna, the Greek goddess Selena, why you have selenography, or the study of the moon, to the man of the moon. And it's really the face that they saw of the Mare on the sea.
That's what it
is. The basaltic cavities on the moon that they translated into a and this is something, of course, that persists and comes back again. And Pliny called them the spots, something that Galileo also would use. He would call them spots.
I love that there seems to me so much fun stuff about the moon versus the sun. I don't know why that is for me. But when I look at artwork, when I look at cartoons, when I look at... comic images, there's more things about the moon than there is the sun. Is that because it was changeable? I mean, it was associated, you know, the changeable moon. It had those associations with it.
Well, I'm a solar astronomer, so I don't know that
See, you gravitated towards the constant, which is not. The sun, which is the positive image. The moon has always been associated with, like, sort of more negative things, too.
I think that's possibly true, and also mystery, because you do see it majorly at night. Okay?
Yeah, you're right.
And it is changeable, and you can always look at it, and you can begin to fantasize on it. I think it's—I hate to say it—but the original Babylonian, it was a god of the sun, but then it went to a goddess, and it's a male-female thing. The moon was thought to be male, Apollo, and
right.
The sun was thought to be, the moon was thought to be female, Selena and Luna. But I think it's because of its interchangeable. You can see it. And it wasn't really, fun wasn't poked at it until they really understood it. I mean, you had the man in the moon, but that was trying to quantify it. But no one really poked fun at it until people understood it and it was begun to be mapped so that it was a physical, tangible item. And then people went wild. I mean, you've got Cyrano de Bergerac.
Right.
You know, currently there's the movie. He wrote in 1657, I think it was, Another World, in which he talked about traveling to the moon and the sun. I mean, wild sci-fi.
Wow.
Crazy.
Well, people actually thought the moon could have been inhabited for a while, too, didn't they?
Well, yes. Oh. In the 19th century, there was one of the New York newspaper proprietors had a big series that got a lot of readership. But people had long thought that the planets must be inhabited. And even 100 years before that, there were just widespread ideas that everything must be inhabited.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. We're welcoming back, returning, Roberta J.M. Olson, curator of drawing at the New York Historical Society and professor emerita of art history at Wheaton College, and J.M. Pasikoff, Field Memorial Professor of Astronomy and Director of the Hopkins Observatory at Williams College. And we're continuing our conversation about the book they co-authored, which is, I think, one of the most amazing science art books I've ever come across. It's Cosmos, the Art and Science of the Universe. Now, I want to talk about Hevelius, who is considered the father of selenography. Is that's the study of
selenography.
Selenography.
Selene was the goddess of the moon.
Selena, right, Selene. And he was the founder of lunar topography, right? He was a Polish brewer and an astronomer.
He did a beautiful big book. I do have a copy.
Wow.
With a very high resolution star, lunar maps, a lot of detail on, of course, the front side of the moon.
Yeah. Well, they wouldn't know otherwise, right? They couldn't see it.
Yes, that's my point exactly.
Did they imagine anything about what the other side of the moon was like? I mean, did they think odd thoughts about what was on the other side of the moon? Were there any theories?
You know, I don't know about that.
Okay. Now, there was a Lunar Society of Burma.
But I do know that the Chinese have recently landed on it.
That's right.
And picked up some... material to bring back to Earth.
In 2019, and the Russians before that were the first to fly around with Luna 3, so that there were images of that side of the moon. And you mentioned one of my favorite things, which was the Lunar Society, founded in Birmingham in 1765.
Yeah.
They called themselves Lunartics, not Lunatics, okay?
The Lunartics.
The Lunartics, and Erasmus Darwin was one of the founders, and Wedgwood, the famous pottery maker. It was a very progressive society of intellectuals who met not because they liked to gaze at the moon, but because it was safer to travel at night with the moon out. And so they calculated their monthly meetings according to the moon.
Wow. See, that's the kind of society I wish I was still around, because I would definitely join.
Now, maybe you can found one.
Yeah, I can find our own right here. There, increasingly, as time goes on, more and more artists incorporate the moon. John Russell was a portraitist and a British artist, but he did these, and you have some in the book, these incredible sketches of the moon, which I thought were amazingly detailed. They almost look like photographs.
They're wonderful, and they're in pastel, so they have... almost a three-dimensional quality and a tactility. You can touch them. He spent 40 years studying the moon, and he was a portrait painter. You're absolutely right. But he did portraits of the moon and was obsessed with it, and he also did observations. And then what he produced, which is really, really rare, there's one in the Science Museum in London, he manufactured gores like a map, okay? And then he put it on a round sphere like a globe, like a globe of the Earth, okay? And he called it a selenographia. So it's like a small terrestrial globe. This was in the late 18th century. And you would turn it around, and of course, I don't know what he did about the...
I know.
Quote, unquote, far side.
Did you just make it up? I mean, well,
there's a wonderful globe of the moon, a foot across or so, with the drawings of the whole moon pasted on it that was made 100 years ago and is sitting in the Museum of Jurassic Technology, which is a wonderful, quirky museum in Culver City, California. So if any of you are out at anywhere near UCLA or Los Angeles or the airport, it's worth a visit to the Museum of Jurassic Technology.
Now let's talk about lunar eclipses, because we have one coming up.
Yes, and I'm just looking at a picture on my screen now by Trouvelo, who 110 years ago came to this country from France, and he was a good artist, and he brought what we used to call gypsy moths, are now called globe moths, I think, as of last month, to improve the terminology, and when a couple escaped and led to the current infestation, he went and saw the people at the Harvard Observatory and started doing astronomical drawings. So one of his series of a dozen or so is of a partial eclipse of the moon, and he has a beautiful series of drawings of all kinds of astronomical things.
Now, eclipses of the sun are dramatic. You know, the sun's out, there's an eclipse happens, the whole area gets dark or shaded. I always found eclipses of the moon to be much more subtle. Did people realize from the beginning that there were eclipses of the moon? It was one of those things that came with more detailed observation.
Well, certainly it was known. I've heard that it was known hundreds and hundreds of years ago that the shadow of the Earth falling on the moon at eclipses is round, is part of a round edge. And so Columbus knew, and people at the time of Columbus knew that the Earth was round, contrary to the story that is told.
Now, the lunar eclipse that's coming up, it's on May 18th and 19th.
Well, I actually wrote that wrong to you, just misremembering. It's May 15th and 16th.
Okay.
So it's Sunday night, May 15th, and it starts a couple of hours before midnight, but about an hour and a half before midnight, you'll start seeing the shadow of the Earth falling on the moon and actually darkening visibly the moon. And that'll go on for about 2.5 hours. But in the middle of that, about a quarter after midnight, the whole moon will be as deeply in the shadow of the Earth as possible. Now, the Earth is a lot bigger than the moon, as you know. So the moon really, really fits sort of in the middle of the Earth. And you'd think that all the sunlight would be cut off, but really, the Earth has an atmosphere. Of course, we're breathing the atmosphere, and over our heads, the sky is blue because the sunlight scatters blue light better than red light. So the red light gets through, and it leaks through all around the edge of the Earth, and so the moon may get thousands of times fainter, but it glows faintly reddish.
I've noticed that in other lunar eclipses. It has a weird color to it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So
it depends on the season, too, and how close things are, because it's an elliptical orbit. And this is a penumbral eclipse, right?
No, it's a total eclipse.
It's a total one. Oh, that's going to be fun.
And it's visible from here.
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, that's one of the things about total eclipses of the moon compared to total eclipses of the Earth. The whole half the Earth at which the moon is visible sees the eclipse, because we're really looking at the moon and the shadow falling on the moon. Whereas for a total eclipse of the sun, to get the maximum effect, you have to be in a narrow path, only 100 or 200 miles across.
Now,
people see a total eclipse of the moon, many more people than seeing a total eclipse of the sun.
Now, give the dates out again. Give out the dates again, please.
So it's a Sunday night, May 15th, going past midnight into Monday, May 16th.
Okay.
Just coming up.
I remember one time in Rome where I didn't know there was going to be a lunar eclipse. And we were, my husband and I were sitting eating outside, and all of a sudden we saw it start. But we prolonged our dinner, okay, for the entire one, and then it was very close, and there was a lot of red on the moon, and it was huge in the sky. It was the best lunar eclipse I had ever seen.
Wow.
It's well worth watching.
Now,
so of course, we need clear weather on that night to see it.
And here in New England, that's not a thing that you can count on.
No.
Well, the statistics I just looked up, about two-thirds of the time, it's clear enough to see.
Okay.
Near where I live in western Massachusetts on May 15th.
We're almost out of time. We only have minutes left. I got to talk to you about books and movies about the moon that came out in the late 19th century and into the 20th century. Jules Verne and
Voyage to the Moon.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And H.G. Wells, First Men in the Moon, which were two.
And Millet's film.
Millet's film has got to be my favorite image of the moon ever.
Can get that easily on YouTube.
If you've never seen it,
Google it.
I think a couple of minute
movie of a trip to the moon by gunpowder. Really,
and there was a weird movie made in the 60s of the H.G. Wells book, a British movie, which had effects by Ray Harryhausen, which had all the selenites and all the weird things that went on in the moon. The idea of the moon, even at that time, and we're talking about the late 1800s into the early 1900s. H.G. Wells wrote about there was an atmosphere that was there on the moon some of the time. So it was like down inside the moon, there was an atmosphere. When did people finally understand what the moon was about? Like, for real, was it in the 20th century only?
Well, really in 1969, July 20th, when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed.
I was watching it.
And they said it looks like dirty beach sand.
That's right.
It's kind of surprising that it's only 4 or 5% reflective because it looks so bright in contrast against the dark sky.
I'll never forget that. That was so bizarre.
Well, we're hoping that Stephanie Wilson and other American astronauts, as part of the Artemis 1 mission, goes back to the moon in the next couple of years.
It's about time. People got bored with the moon missions. I can't believe it. It like lost public support.
But many space efforts did, and that's a shame. Hopefully it'll be back. We know that SpaceX is obviously planning trips to the moon. People are signing up to be tourists, which is
crazy. But I don't want millionaires going to the moon. I want astronauts going to the moon.
Astronauts going to the moon, it has to be scientific. It can't be
absolutely
exploited.
With that,
because you've got to conserve it.
Let's sign off. My guest tonight, returning, Roberta J.M. Olson, curator of drawing at the New York Historical Society and professor emerita of art history at Wheaton College, and J.M. Paskoff, field memorial professor of astronomy and director of the Hopkins Observatory at Williams College, and we've been talking about Cosmos, the Art and Science of the Universe. Wonderful book. Thank you both for being
here.
Thanks
for inviting us.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.
Great.